Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Thank you for downloading this podcast from the Financial Times. We value your feedback. Please go to ft.com/alpha survey and fill out a short survey.
Hello, and welcome to Alpha Chat, the business and economics podcast from the Financial Times. I'm Shannon Bond. On today's show, what happens after a December rate rise? Many economists expect the Fed will announce it will raise interest rates before the end of the year. I'll be joined by U.S. capital markets correspondent Eric Platt to talk about what monetary policy changes economists are expecting to see as we move into 2016. Then, the American middle class is shrinking. New data from the Pew Research Center suggests that globalization and advancements in technology have driven a wedge between people in what was once the majority class. I'll talk to two of our editors in Washington. Plus, economist Claudia Golden on the last chapter of Gender Convergence in the Workplace. Let's get on with the show. It's the most wonderful time of the year for Fed watchers again. On Wednesday, Fed Chairwoman Janet Yellen and the Federal Open Market Committee will announce if the central bank will raise interest rates for the first time in nearly a decade. Eric Platt, U.S. capital markets correspondent, is here with me in the studio. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Shannon. How's it going?
Good. The Fed funds rate has been at a record low of zero for nearly a decade. That's like practically the entire time I've been at the FT. So you've been speaking to some economists recently. Is a December rate rise in the cards? Is it all but certain?
December rate rise is all but certain. I think those are the exact words. So far, every economist I've spoken to besides one has said December is the date. They are all betting that it's a 25 basis point rise, which is a quarter of a percentage point. And they think it happens next Wednesday.
So that seems to suggest that there is a bit more positive feeling about the health of the U.S. economy, right? What might be reassuring the Fed and the economists that you've spoken to that a rise is in order?
So a lot of the economists we've been talking to, we've been asking, what are the odds that a recession happens next year or the year after? What would force the Fed to come back to zero and stimulate? And almost none of them think having a majority opinion that recession is on the horizon. Only one that we've surveyed so far has said, you know, the Fed's going back to zero. They think, get off the zero bound so if there's a crisis in the future, we can come back down. Interestingly, people have only recently come to the view again that, oh, Fed hiking is good for the economy. It means that there's strength in the underlying business activity, what we're seeing, jobs growth, retail spending, kind of the core group, even though the figures have been kind of lackluster.
But there's not that fear that if rates do go up, that could grind everything to a halt and like send us back into another recession.
No, I think even if the Fed makes a policy mistake, I don't think anyone thinks it's the 25 basis point move because it seems so, I just want to say, like, inconsequential. The dollar.
Well, right. It is. I mean, it's not a very big move. I mean, it's just a quarter point, right?
No, it's not. And it gets more interesting. And this is where, when we've been surveying people, there's been such a wide dispersion so far of how much does the Fed go in 2016 and how much do they go in 2017. Some economists say they are one and done. This is it. Others say we're getting four hikes next year and we might get six in 2017, which is kind of surprising because that is much more aggressive than the market is currently pricing.
Right. So that's sort of where we're extending our timeline out now about what to worry about. So what about long-term rates?
So once again, this is where we see a lot of dispersion. The Fed itself has said that long-term rates should be around 3 to 3.5. So we should start seeing U.S. Treasury yields start to rise. The economists we polled have offered really varying views, some as high as 4, some as low as 2, which would indicate that yields could go anywhere.
So heading into next Wednesday, equity markets have been stabilizing, but corporate bond markets have seemed a little jittery. Any sense that this is a sign of some other types of worries?
Yeah. So one of the big things in markets is a lot of times fixed income markets, credit will lead the equity indices. So if there's, investors getting nervous and they're selling bonds of either investment grade or junk rated companies, maybe a few months later, you'll see the sell off in equities. And there's been a divergence. Investment grade credit has widened out a bit. There's been some of a sell off. Junk rated bonds, particularly because of the energy issues, the drop in oil prices, have sold off massively. And a lot of investors point to the fact that in the past when this has happened, there's been a recession on the horizon. And in the past when it's happened, it's not just energy. It's, it starts in energy or it starts in whatever sector and it moves to retail and media and pharma. Oh, by the way, we've seen all those things already.
So we think that companies will probably continue to sell bonds despite these potential concerns from investors.
Yeah, one of the things I loved recently about when I was talking to some investors, they're like, yeah, we've been pushing back on these deals, but companies have not gotten the message. And we've seen a record pace of investment grade issuance this year. Talking to bankers and investors, I think that's going to continue next year because, again, 25 basis point move higher in rates, that doesn't stop me from issuing a $10 billion bond if I'm Pfizer or Verizon or McDonald's.
So how are markets positioned heading into this decision next week?
So one of the most interesting things that we saw recently was a report JP Morgan put out, and they said there are about $1.1 trillion in options contracts for the December period. And funny enough, the December period expiry date, when you have to decide to exercise the options, is less than 48 hours after the Fed. Now, a lot of those options are put options, which gives the holder a right to sell the stock, or in this case, the S&P 500. And they're positioned just below where the market is currently trading, between like 1900 and 2050. I think the S&P is around 2070 right now. So let's say the market were to drop substantially on Thursday. If those holders decide to exercise their options, and it's about $200 billion in contracts there, you could see the market sell off substantially following the Fed. And it could just be an acceleration made worse by these options contracts. JP Morgan strategist said, oh, that's not, that's really a worst case scenario. We don't think it'll happen because the Fed will likely be dovish. But something to keep on your radar if you see a massive sell off after the Fed continue into Thursday and Friday.
Yeah, that risk is definitely there. Thanks so much, Eric. Our listeners can read the full results of our discussions with economists this weekend on FT.com.
Thanks for having me, Shannon.
America's middle class has shrunk from less than half of the country's population for the first time since the start of the 1970s. Technology and globalization have driven a wedge between the winners and losers in American society, hollowing out what was once the majority class. This is all according to new data from the Pew Research Center. Two FT journalists, U.S. economics editor Sam Fleming and World Trade editor Sean Donnan, worked closely with Pew to analyze the data. And Sam and Sean join me on the line from Washington. Hi, guys.
Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Shannon.
Hello. So, first of all, how are we defining the middle class? Like, how does Pew and you in the piece that you've done, what does the middle class mean?
Well, Pew divides the U.S. Adult population into five different income tiers. And the middle they define as two-thirds to 200% of U.S. median income. So if you're a three-person household, that means you're earning anywhere from $41,869 to $125,608. Obviously, you can define the middle class in any number of ways. There are other income definitions which other people use, other academic institutions use. And you can also do it in a more touchy feely way, I suppose. Is it white collar America? Is it the portion of America which can afford to own its own home? There are any number of ways of defining the middle class, but this is the way Pew does it.
And actually, there's a really important point here as well, which is this is probably the broadest measure on the income side of the American middle class out there. So going anywhere from 40,000 to 125 plus thousand captures just a huge segment of America. But even that segment of America has shrunk, and the reasons for that are where it gets really interesting.
Right. So we see now this new data. It's less than half of the adult population that now fits within that group. So just to give some context, how big was it at the peak?
So back in the beginning of the 1970s, it was 61% of the adult population. So it's really shrunk quite steadily. And that's one of the findings from Pew. This isn't a sudden result of the Great Recession. It's not a sudden result of deindustrialization, for instance, in the 1980s and 90s. This is something that's been happening for a really long time.
And what are the most significant factors then along the way, if it's not just sort of the things that have been more immediately brought to our attention, like the Occupy movement?
So actually, so this is the really striking thing that comes out of this research, is that actually perhaps the bigger reason for the middle class shrinking is, or the biggest reason for the middle class shrinking is actually that a lot more Americans than you would have thought have gotten richer and moved beyond the middle class and up the income ladder. And that's really surprising, and it's kind of counterintuitive given what we get out there in the popular discourse. Now, clearly there's people who have fallen out of the middle class, but there's something like 50 million adults in America now living in households earning more than $125,000 a year. That's one in five American adults. That's a pretty striking number.
Yeah, that's a big, big shift. So on the lower end, or on the sort of the lower wage job end, since the 1970s, there's been obviously this expansion in globalization, the automation of many manufacturing positions sort of that would have been, you know, factory jobs. What kind of professions did you guys see were most affected?
Well, one of the important things that comes out of this is education and the importance of college education. That was a really big, one of the very big dividing lines in terms of people's fortunes. If you don't have a college education, you've actually fallen down the income brackets over this period, whereas people with a college education or more have really held their own. And so that's all.
Even factoring in the effect of like the cost of what it costs, of what you have to pay for college in the U.S.?
Exactly. Exactly. So this is an important point, that college education really is paying off. And this reflects the premium that employers are putting on high-skilled workers. And that's also, as you suggest, reflected in those occupations that have done well, rising in income status. Amongst those that have done very well are executives, managers, perhaps not surprisingly, people with professional qualifications, technicians, medical professionals, all doing very well, whereas more administrative roles haven't done so well. Operators haven't done well, and interestingly, teachers haven't done well either.
And other public sector workers potentially, right, with the budget cuts that we've seen?
Yeah, well, we think that one of the reasons teachers haven't done well is because of the squeeze on state and local budgets, which has been reflected in the teachers' profession. Certainly separate figures, which aren't from Pew, show that in the decade up to 2013-14, in real terms, teachers' incomes have fallen about 4%. So they've seen a decline there.
So as part of this big package that you've done, you both traveled to a bunch of different parts of the country to meet with people who may be now or may have been considered middle class. Can you tell us some of those stories that you came across?
The one that really sticks with me is Amber Barnard, who's a 37-year-old mother of three who works for Cummings in Seymour, Indiana. She's a slight blonde lady, and she builds big, huge diesel engines in this plant. But one of the things that's really striking is you go to a town like Seymour, and you discover a place that actually is doing pretty well, oddly. I mean, this is the counterintuitive point. It's the opposite of the manufacturing story we normally hear about America. It's a place that's managing to survive. And Amber is probably the most effusive member of the middle class that I met in my travels. You know, a lot of people who actually materially are doing better than Amber in terms of their income are much more pessimistic about the state of the middle class than she is. And to me, that's a really interesting thing. And it's not just about individuals, but it's also about communities. If you can adapt to the new economy, and if you can take advantage of where things are doing well, you can actually have a very good life in America, even on the factory floor. But you do get this very divided sense of the U.S. economy when you travel around.
Sam, did you meet anyone that you felt sort of encapsulated some point in this research?
Sure, a number of people, but one to bring out would be Will Hansman, who's the chief technology officer at a startup in Chicago called Uptake, which specializes in gathering huge amounts of data and analyzing it to try and predict failures in machinery and other operations of big companies. I guess I was just struck by the sense that if you are in one of these high-tech industries with the kind of skills that someone like Will has, where he's got a degree in aerospace engineering from University of Illinois, has spent his career in various corners of the technology sector, you're in a really excellent position right now. And that was reflected in his own assessment, I thought, of how the middle class is doing, where he basically thinks the middle class in the US is extremely resilient and thriving, in his words. That is not the kind of message you get, on the other hand, from a teacher such as Julie Ruhlin, who I also spoke to, based in Virginia, who feels that she has to have a second job in order to make ends meet, even as a teacher in what should be a kind of core middle-class profession. Another teacher I spoke to, Tina Williams, also based in Virginia, also has a second job working in a department store. So these are kind of the bedrock of the middle class, but people who don't feel they've done very well.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, should be absolutely clear. It's and I was talking about communities that adapt very well. I also, as part of the series, traveled to a place called Eden, North Carolina, which is a community that just has not adapted at all to modern realities. It's a place where 1 in 4 people live in poverty. It's a real kind of great example or depressing example of deindustrialized America there. And there you run into people who are holding down 5 jobs to make a wage that is still below median income and really struggling with huge social problems as well.
So a huge divide. Now, you mentioned, I mean, obviously high-skilled technical workers have benefited. Are there other groups of people who have been less touched by this shift or have benefited, whether it's sort of by employment or by age?
No, I mean, I think that's part of the key, and that's part of the key story here is, I mean, and we've known this, but it's good to be a baby boomer.
Yep, yep. What about the younger generation? What about sort of young college graduates, people starting families, finally the elusive millennials that we love to talk about?
Well, in terms of income status, and the way we talk about income status in this report, or Pew talks about it, is looking at whether people have, a larger number of people have moved up the income ladder to higher income tiers or down the income ladder to lower tiers. The real declines you've seen have been in the younger generations, as well as in people who don't have college educations. Those have really been the losers. I think the other point to make about the older generation is they have seen a lot of upward mobility in terms of income since 1971, and indeed in the current century as well. That doesn't change the fact that if you are over 65, you're still more likely to be a lower income person than the overall U.S. population, reflecting the fact that a lot of people who are in their 60s and above are living on quite a modest income, even if that has improved over the decades.
And they're hanging on in the workforce for longer. I mean, that's another thing. I mean, Sam went down to Florida, and in Sarasota, Florida, he interviewed A.V. Osterman, who's this wonderful, chipper 75-year-old office manager, and she talks about, you know, being a member of the middle class, being happy. At the same time, she's 75 years old and still working.
Right. Well, on this podcast, and we've talked about this, what's going to happen, sort of the technology that will enable people to work longer, but also clearly a lot of people are going to have to work longer. So you guys are both in D.C. You kind of can't quite escape the gravity, the pull of the presidential campaign. It seems that, you know, this kind of shift that we've seen creates this void where Republicans and Democrats alike, the presidential candidates, can fill with promises of how they're going to help Americans, whether it's through tax breaks or higher wages. I mean, what do you make? What will this add anything or provide shed any light on the political discourse?
Well, I guess it confirms, in a sense, what you hear from both sides of the political divide, the sense that the American middle class is under pressure and is being squeezed badly. You hear that from Trump, who's been talking about cutting taxes for the middle class, while, of course, his tax package also includes some beneficial moves for richer Americans, all the way over to Bernie Sanders, who's talking about universal health care and other things, again, aimed at a free college education, aimed at helping the middle class to get back some of those gains that it's lost over the past few decades. So I think this is going to be one of the central theme. I mean, security is obviously going to be a huge theme in the presidential debates coming up next year. But I think the middle class, in terms of the economics of America, is going to be the central theme.
Thank you both for joining me. Our listeners can follow the series, including video sketches and all of your articles, at ft.com/middleclass. Sam, Sean, thanks so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
The gender pay gap expands enormously in the first 15 years that people are out. And the second point is that the gender earnings gap is considerably wider, like very much wider, in certain occupations than it is in others.
That's Harvard economics professor Claudia Golden. She's talking to Cardiff about the gender pay gap across different occupations in the latest episode of Alpha Chatterbox. It's the subject of a paper she wrote called A Grand Gender Convergence, The Last Chapter, in which she argues that the roles of men and women have essentially converged in the workplace during the last century. Yet major changes in the way work is incentivized are needed in order for men and women to achieve real equality, or what she calls the last chapter of this convergence, in the labor market. Here she is on the idea of time and flexibility at work.
So my theory was that what was going on is that certain jobs, certain positions were more nonlinear than others. And that if an individual needs to have more temporal flexibility. So it's not just the number of hours, it's when you work your hours. I want to work at 2 in the morning, not at 2 in the afternoon. But if I'm working for a consulting firm and I'm not there at 2 in the afternoon, then I won't be able to have the 2 p.m. meeting with the team of individuals who have to be together. Okay, so I am not being afforded temporal flexibility. If I take it, I'm going to be put in a position where I'm going to be earning a lot less. I'm going to get clients that are less demanding, for example. There are 100 different reasons why one might find these nonlinearities or this cost of this amenity that's worth more for individuals like women who have demands outside their occupation. So that was the idea, that what is going on, what is penalizing women disproportionately, is due to the high cost in certain occupations like law, like corporate and finance, less so in others like certain health occupations and certain tech and science occupations. This cost, this very, very high cost of this amenity called temporal flexibility related to these nonlinearities in pay. So armed with that theory, I then go back into the labor force and see whether these occupations really have these nonlinearities, or occupations have evolved so that they are more what we call female and family friendly without the costs of sometimes friendliness has costs, with lower cost to it. And that is the essence of what must be in the last chapter, that we must reduce the cost of the amenity, temporal flexibility.
You can download the full Alpha Chatterbox episode with Claudia Golden now. For this week's follow-up, as always, I'm joined by Amelia Mahasek. Hi, Amelia.
Hello, Shannon.
So last week, we had a lot of different things.
You did have a real variety of things. So first up, BlackBerry, the book about the sort of demise, really, of BlackBerry, although it's still trying to struggle along and compete with Apple. The most interesting thing, as always, I know I bang on about this, is the human element of business. And so I really was fascinated about the tale of these two men who really were the ones that were behind this, you know, rise, this extraordinary company, and that interplay between the engineer who was the tech brains, whose parents, you know, helped him fund the company in the first place, immigrant background, you know, born in Istanbul, you know, won a science prize for reading every book in the library when he grew up. And then this business brain, Jim Basile. So Michael Azarides is a tech guy, and Jim Basile with the business brain, who was entrusted to kind of make this thing grow and grow and grow. So I thought that was really interesting. And so my takeaway from that was, you know, we must do more corporate stories about the humans behind the machine.
Right, the sort of the personalities and the culture.
Yeah, because quite often, generally in business journalism, we treat companies as though they're run by a sort of spreadsheet.
Right.
And actually, they're run by people with all kinds of flaws and traits and genius and all that kind of thing. So So that's what I really liked about that. I thought Amy did a great job of pulling all of that out.
Yes, more interviews by Amy.
Yes. And then we segued to the renminbi and why it's a reserve currency.
Or why it doesn't matter that it's a reserve currency.
It's a reserve currency. It matters to the Chinese. And but my ears pricked up when I heard that, you know, even the Australian dollar and the Canadian dollar are not included in the reserve currencies, even though they are held more widely than the renminbi. But so that was really interesting because normally that's such a geeky topic, currency trading.
Yeah, no, but I think, I mean, they made it explicable.
Exactly. The sort of politics behind it all is fascinating. And I was left by the third segment on Chicago not being very welcoming to George Lucas about his donation there, thinking about why San Francisco had rejected him and what the sort of dynamics are in San Francisco.
Right, the old money, new money split.
The politics of San Francisco, just as much as the politics of Chicago.
Right, because essentially the tech billionaires were all backing the Lucas project, but sort of the powers that be, the old money that I think is more controlling of the Presidio Trust, wasn't interested in it. So
it's funny because I don't think of San Francisco as having any old money. I think it's all new money.
Well, but it's like it's been so many cycles of new money, right? Like it's always been a boom. It's like gone through these boom cycles. And so that at some point that becomes old money, right?
Exactly.
The robber barons, the railroads, all of those things.
Yeah. Well, I think I remember from going to San Francisco and looking up a bit of the history that, you know, in the old trading days when it was all shipping, it was similar sort of culture, boom and bust. So I thought that was great.
Thanks, Amelia.
Thank you, Shannon. Have you been reading this week?
I've been reading a couple different things, but actually what I want to recommend is a movie, The Big Short. Which was a book, which is also a great book. So first of all, yes, I recommend that as a book. I'd read that book a couple years ago when it came out by Michael Lewis. Now it's been made into a movie, which is coming out, I think, more widely, maybe a little down the line.
But you had a sneak preview.
I got to go to an early screening because I got to talk to the director this week for a piece that will be in this weekend's FT, which is really fun. So the director, Adam McKay, probably best known as a collaborator with Will Ferrell on movies like Anchorman and Talladega Nights. Like, he's a comedian. His background's in comedy in Chicago. I mean, so that's sort of an interesting choice, right?
Does he make the movie funny?
He makes it funny, not in a funny,
that's good.
Amazing way, but like, ha-ha. Well, no, there are simply laugh-out-loud moments, but one of the things he told me in the interview is that he thinks, you know, sort of from his background in comedy, like one of the things that's brought him, he really understands the audience. Like to be successful in comedy, particularly in sketch and improv comedy, you really got to know your audience and you got to be able to like keep it entertaining. Mm-hmm. And so he definitely does that because, I mean, this could definitely be a dry story, right? It's about the housing bubble. It's about a bunch of traders who dug through mortgages and dug through spreadsheets to sort of see this pattern and see that there was a bubble before most other people were able to. And I mean, this was something in the book, Michael Lewis telling, he's great at this. He tells the story in a really great way. And a lot of it is very personality driven. Speaking of interesting people in the news, these characters turned out to be really fascinating guys. And McKay definitely picks up on that for the movie. And then just, he doesn't, you know, there are things you can do in a movie you can't necessarily do in a book. And he also, this is probably the most written thing about it, but you know, he interjects these moments where the movie kind of pauses the narrative. And then he brings out celebrities to explain these finance concepts. So Selena Gomez is in a casino and she explains the concept of synthetic derivatives by like talking about betting on blackjack and people betting on her performance in blackjack. What I thought was kind of overall more interesting is just that Adam McKay is actually a really political guy. He's a lefty. He has been quite involved, like sort of been following a lot of what's happened since the crisis in terms of banking regulations. His website, Funny or Die, and has done some sort of advocacy videos for the Consumer Protection Agency and also for Obama's healthcare plan. It's something that he like sort of takes a layperson's interest in, probably more than most lay people.
We should have him on Alpha.
Yeah, he was great. He's really smart and really opinionated about this.
And an FT fan.
And it comes through. And it comes through in the film because he gets it, but he also gets like why it might be alienating to to people who aren't as familiar with it and then tells the story in a way that makes it not alienating. So
I can't wait to read the piece and see the movie.
Yeah, so I highly recommend everyone go and see it.
So I'm reading The Story of a New Name by Elena Franti, the second book in her four-part series, which you would never read based on the cover photo or the name of The Story of a New Name. The Italian author who we don't know the identity of is secret identity. Actually, Paris Review did an excellent interview with the unnamed author explaining motivations. But anyways, I've heard criticism in my book club actually that nothing happens. Right. But actually, I think
lots
the
happens.
Book
just
is like life.
Yep.
Nothing happens and everything happens.
Right.
So I find that fascinating.
So the book I'm reading now is Kathy Eden and Luke Schaefer's $2 a Day, Living on Almost Nothing in America. It's this really interesting look by two poverty researchers at really extreme poverty in the U.S. I mean, what's amazing is you think of the global poverty measure for the World Bank. They just shifted it up to $1.90 a day. And really, the idea that here in America, there are actually people who live on this. And you get this amazing tour through urban America, through Chicago to rural Mississippi. Where they talk to actual people who are living on $2 a day. Really interesting stuff. Really worth a read.
And that's all we have this week. Thanks so much for listening. Go to ft.com/alphachat for show notes, links, and our guest recommendations. We'd love to hear your recommendations. You can call us at 917-551-5012, email us at alphachat@ft.com, or tweet me at Shannon Parail, ShannonParail. And special treat, Cardiff comes back next week. We'll hear about his trip to Cuba. Amy Keene produces our show.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of The Next Five podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next Five wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.